Welcome to Nature's Edge. This is Dale Stewart. As most know, I'm a strong advocate for wetland and coastal ecosystem conservation. Wetlands, streams, and our coastal ecosystem are indispensable habitat for hundreds of species of birds and other wildlife. These waters filter pollution, provide drinking water for over 100 million people in the United States, and safeguard our communities from storms. Yet many of these areas have remained in limbo for years, even though the science is clear that streams and their adjacent wetlands should be conserved. Streams and wetlands also significantly affect the quality of other waters, such as rivers and lakes. It is important that we reverse the current trend of wetland and coastal ecosystem degradation, work towards environmental sustainability. I believe it is important to develop strategies to reintroduce elements of the natural ecology and therefore support the entire system by supporting its ecosystem functions. We must also bring into the discussion the men, women, and children who live and work in or near these unique ecosystems. A prime example is the coastal ecosystem that supports the nation's oldest bilingual culture, the Cajuns of Louisiana's coastal region. Our guest today on Nature's Edge is going to help us better understand these unique ecosystems. Dr. Melissa Booth is a marine microbiologist who has studied microbes from the Arctic to the Antarctic in lakes, rivers, estuaries, open oceans, and salt marsh ecosystems. Melissa was recently a research faculty member at the University of Georgia Marine Institute and lived embedded within the coastal salt marsh for 6.5 years. She recently also co-authored a chapter in the new book, Wetland Habitats of North America, Ecology and Conservation Concerns. Today, Melissa is focused on communicating science to the public to raise awareness of our planetary ecological crisis. Melissa, welcome to Nature's Edge.
Thank you, Dale.
We are really privileged to have you here today, and we're going to start out pretty simplistic because I'm going to ask you, what are wetlands?
Well, in some ways, it's very obvious. It's a place that's wet. But from a scientific definition, the soils are considered to be hydric, meaning that water excludes the air. And that specifically controls the kind of vegetation that can grow in that location. So a wetland is distinctively set apart from other places in that the soil is anoxic or lacks oxygen, causing the plant community to be different.
And there are many different types of wetlands, correct?
There are several different kinds. There are swamps, which are forested, meaning they have hardwoods or woody plants. There are marshes, which have grasses, mostly grasses and sedges. There are fens and bogs, and they're mires. Those are wet places that accumulate peat. Yeah. Bogs are separated from fens in that bogs are acidic. They're slow to develop because most of their water comes in through precipitation, whereas fens get their water from groundwater and surface water, and they're typically alkaline.
And we can actually have bogs in the mountains, correct? We have little bogs areas, I know, in the Appalachian.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Areas. So so when we think about wetlands, they really cover any number of types of areas that have water or hold water. Now, this is something like the Everglades or coastal Louisiana. They're kind of a combination, correct?
Yes, they are.
These coastal areas, because they have trees and they also have marsh grass and other types.
Right, so you have a gradient of marshes moving into tidal freshwater lands, moving into swamps. Swamps are really special in that the water is stagnant and not moving. In those other systems, the water is moving. So the water movement, the physicality of water, is more what's controlling the physical conformation of that wetland. Swamps are special in that the water is standing still, stagnant, and so you have trees able to grow.
They do grow in there. I know in South Louisiana, which is the area that I'm most familiar with in the coastal wetlands down there, one of the problems, and you and I were talking about this a little before the show, was the intrusion of salt into those wetlands, into those freshwater wetlands. And I can remember as a youngster growing up in South Louisiana seeing acres and acres and acres of these magnificent cypress trees. And when I was down there recently on one of my research expeditions, to see those same trees all standing dead. And cypress grow in water, but they don't do too well when the salt water gets in there.
Oh, no, not at all. And there's saltwater intrusion on coastal Georgia and Florida as well, and that's due to dredging for shipping container ships to be able to move in, and they're just pushing too far into the the landscape underneath the water, and salt water is able to flow into the groundwater, which is the drinking water source for that part of the country.
Yeah, and, that's the same problem in Louisiana. As you know, we have the huge oil and gas down there, and the largest port in the United States is in South Louisiana. So, yeah, man has gone in, and we dredged these canals, which if you look at an aerial map, you can see them because they're straight lines. And Mother Nature doesn't do straight too much with her water. And those have allowed the salt water to actually flow in. And also seeing some of the magnificent oak trees, which Louisiana is known for. These you cannot see a photograph of South Louisiana without a huge oak tree with Spanish moss hanging from it. And to see those dead, because they grow on land and not water. So that's just another reason. We're going to talk about many reasons why wetlands need to be conserved and saved, and that's just one of them. We're wetlands. We talked a little bit about, we do have the different types of wetlands, and we talked about bogs being in the Appalachian area, but wetlands as a whole, they're not just along coastal areas, are they?
No,
over the United States.
No, they're all over the United States, and when you think of the global wetlands, you usually think of three things: the Mississippi River and the wetlands associated with that, the Amazon River Basin, and the Siberian permafrost. That is an amazing wetland. But we have similar wetlands in the United States. Most of them are concentrated on the coast, but also around the Great Lakes, Alaska. We have some types in the High Plains, where I'm from, called playas. They're ephemeral and important to recharging, for instance, the Ogallala Aquifer, which is not recharging anymore. And there are also wetlands in Alaska in the Arctic tundra.
Yes, and I'm fortunate that I've been in most of those areas you've mentioned. Most of the people know I'm very familiar with the Amazon and also the Mississippi River, as I've paddled both of those. But I'm also very familiar with the tundra in northern Alaska. Let me ask you, you're a microbiologist.
Yes, I am.
A marine microbiologist. Is the microbiology vary from wetland to wetland?
Yes, it does, tremendously. And
just
that's
like
one
the
of the things
animals.
That we're very interested in is how microbes are being affected by changes in wetlands due to climate and due to human intervention, whether it be drainage, changing in water patterns, or fertilization. Lots of nitrogen is running off into many of our wetlands, causing changes in plant communities, but changes in the microbial communities, which then changes nutrient structure and how that cycled around the planet, which could have all sorts of impacts.
So really, some of the problems that we're seeing are almost from the smallest members upward.
Absolutely.
That they're impacting what's going on everywhere else. And I know, didn't you do some work in the Antarctic?
I did.
Did you get into the dry valleys any? Or?
I did not get into the dry valleys. I was mostly along the coast or out in the open water.
Yeah,
so.
The dry valleys are amazing.
Yes.
And there's a river there called the Anx.
Yes, I've heard of it.
I plan to paddle.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, it's actually a glacial runoff, but it's the only river recognized in the Antarctic, and it's never been paddled.
Hmm.
So it's calling my name.
Oh, I'd like to go with you.
Oh, yeah. We're trying to get it done in January of 2015, so just in a few months. Leslie, why are you waving a finger at me? Guys, you have no idea what I have to go through here some days. But do we have a minute left, or we have 30 seconds?
30 seconds.
We have 30 seconds left. My guest today in studio is Dr. Melissa Booth. And Melissa and I are talking about wetlands and the different types of wetlands, their locations, and so forth. And when we come back, we're gonna talk about some of the major threats to wetlands and things like that. Leslie is doing crazy things again over here. I see out of the corner of my eye, and I think she wants me to keep talking. So just real quick, how do wetlands affect us in three words or less, Melissa?
They clean our water, they feed us, and they protect our shorelines.
There you go. Okay, we will be back. You're listening to Nature's Edge with Dale Stewart. Welcome back to Nature's Edge. This is Dale Stewart. Today, my special guest is Dr. Melissa Booth. And Melissa and I are talking about wetlands and coastal erosion and what are wetlands and where they're located and many other things. And Melissa, I want to know exactly what does a healthy coastal wetland, what does it provide to mankind and to society in general? Jump in there.
That's an excellent question, Dale. mostly on this planet, we may not think about it much in the United States, but wetlands provide rice. One-fifth of the population of this planet may exist on a bowl of rice a day, so it's the most important foodstuff there is. But also nurseries for fish that we all love to eat. 1 billion people on this planet rely on fish protein as their sole protein source, and another 15% of the rest of the population relies on fish as a protein source for 15% of their diet. So, again, food, number one. Number two, recreation, aesthetics, things like that in the United States are very important to those of us like you and I who are outdoor enthusiasts who like there to be intact nature to lift our spirits and to let us get outdoors and reconnect with our natural selves. But also, flood protection is one of the most important things in the United States that wetlands provide.
Well, I know one of the problems that we've had in South Louisiana, and I would assume it's the same problem that we're having along the coastal, the East Coast, is the reduction of our little offshore islands that we had out there for a long time, which actually helped prevent the hurricane, the surges that came in. And I also believe wetlands have something to do with that surge as well, don't they?
Yes, they do. So wetlands can absorb rain as it's falling. And if you have a heavy rain coming in from hurricane or something like that, it slows down the release of that water into the waterways nearby. And so you're reducing the height of waves. You're reducing the speed of water. So you're therefore protecting the land.
And that's the surge.
That's the surge, yes. And the rise is slowed, so you don't have this sudden rise that occurs like we saw in Louisiana.
Is there anything that we can do? Or I know there's a lot of studies being done, a lot of research being done, and some work being done in trying to reestablish some of these little barrier islands. Is that doable?
Yes and no. I think that we can we have proven that we can build islands and things will occur, that plants will seed, trees will grow, but the complexity of the ecosystem will not be the same as we see on these older islands that are still intact that haven't been developed. So you won't have the same ecological structure, and so it's undetermined on whether or not the ecological function will be the same.
Would be the same.
Yes.
I know one of the other things, I know a young lady in South Louisiana that's actually been working on using oyster reefs as a way to slow down that water surge that we get from other things, and using other natural barriers that Mother Nature sort of had in place to do that. Is the same thing being looked at on the East Coast? Are they looking at different?
Yes, they are. In the Chesapeake, they've really made a concerted effort at restoring oyster reefs, mostly for filtration of the water.
Oh, yeah.
Because there's just so much runoff. After you remove the plants along shore and build up the McMansions along the bay, for instance, that you're running along, you have all of the sediment moving into the water, and the oysters help remove a lot of the pollutants and sediment in the water. In coastal Georgia, they've done some studies adding sacks of old oyster shells along where oyster reefs once were before they were harvested to try to get spat to settle and oysters to regrow. And I think they've had mixed results on whether or not that helps stabilize the shore.
For those that don't know, a spat is a baby oyster. It's a seed, correct?
It's
called
a
seed.
Yes.
Yeah, I was talking to Melissa earlier. When I was in college, I used to work in South Louisiana with the Louisiana Wildlife and Fisheries, and one of my jobs was putting spats, or the seeds, in oyster shells. It's amazing how that circle of life continues, and we're still looking at that. But they are a great filtration system.
Yes. As
nature.
A microbiologist, one of the ways that I can study microbial functions in waters and wetlands is by looking at the gut contents of oysters. So I can harvest a few oysters, take out their guts, and look at the microbes that they're eating.
Do you eat what's left over after you take the guts out?
Actually, I don't.
I will have to go with you sometime and do that. I love raw oysters. And I've had all my hepatitis shots just to be on the safe side about that. We're talking about some of the things that we can do to to restore some of the coastal wetlands. What are some things that are going on in the scientific world and in the conservation world to help our wetlands?
There's a lot going on. One of the main things that you can do to restore a wetland is to remove drainage ditch or plug up drainage ditches that have been formed in historically for agricultural purposes or for logging to move logs and whatnot. So plug up those drains. And second, remove the levees. What happens after that is under scientific study. So as recruitment of plants begins to happen, as sedimentation begins to happen again, and those wetlands to rebuild themselves, scientists are documenting how fast that occurs so that we can see how to do it better in other places to try to recover some of the wetlands that have been lost on this planet. On this planet, we've lost 50% of the naturally occurring wetlands over the last 100 years. In some places, up to 99% of the wetlands are completely gone.
And I hate to say it, but we humans are the main culprit, correct?
We are the main culprit. One of the major problems today is shrimp farming. Agriculture in the past has always been a claimer of wetlands. The land was looked at as useless and unproductive, and so it was filled in and drained, and agriculture seemed to be a better way to go. Nowadays, we're doing the same thing in different places. In Belize, I looked at some shrimp farms, China, places like this, Thailand. We're having the same problems. We're losing the wetlands to agriculture.
Yeah, and it's interesting you mentioned Belize. I've spent a lot of time in Belize, and there's an area off of a little stream called Laboring Creek that goes into a very pristine wetlands called Whitewater. And it's been pretty well protected by nature itself because it's very remote. But all of a sudden now, rice growing is becoming a major industry among the farmers in Belize now, and they are right on the edge of wanting to the government to turn over more of that area to them to grow rice. I mean, rice grows well in wetlands. So it's interesting that you brought that up and talk about that. But, yeah, I've looked at wetlands all over the world, and they all seem to have little things in common and that with a problem, and that has been human intervention.
That's right. And the rice growing, as an example, that was tried in the United States in the 1700s. The island that I was living on, Sapelo Island off the coast of Georgia, had a lot of remnant rice paddies that are now natural wetlands, but they don't look like undisturbed wetlands. Even 100 years later, they don't look the same. You can still tell that they were agricultural farmland at one time. And so their ability to act as nurseries for fish or to purify water, filter water, is not as good as an undisturbed wetland.
Yeah, and same thing in coastal Louisiana. I mean, rice was king in South Louisiana for a long time, and it was felt for a long time that agricultural product was more valuable than the wetlands themselves. Fortunately, that is turning a little bit. And you were talking about scientists studying the re-evolvement of wetlands over time, and I'm a great observer of nature. It's one of my passions, and nature is pretty resilient. I mean, it will recover. I almost think sometimes if man would leave it alone, she would go back. And I use the example: if you don't think nature will reclaim, don't mow your yard for a year, and just take a look at it. And our wetlands tend to do that as well. But we seem to continue to study and continue to think that the only way we can do anything about it is for us to get involved and do something else. So Leslie's waving bye to me, so evidently we're coming to the end of this segment. This is Dale Stewart. You're listening to Nature's Edge, and hopefully we will return. Welcome back, friends. This is Dale Stewart. You're tuned to Nature's Edge, and I'm about to sneeze. Yep, didn't do it. The
Gesundheit.
Thank you, Melissa. I'm going to drink some water. Fortunately, our top-notch producer, Leslie, will be able to clean all that up for me. Mm-hmm. We're talking about wetlands, and we're talking about healthy wetlands and what's happened and what's going on with them. And we were just discussing things that man seems to be the ones that have messed things up. So we oftentimes think that man is the only one that has the answer to this. But nature herself, Melissa, can help a lot if we sort of give her head, right?
Yes, nature can do the job if we give her head. I think estimates suggest that if we let things return to normal, plug up drains, remove levees, it takes about 10 to 100 years to recover the vegetation. So on a planetary scale, that's a blink of an eye.
It really is, yeah. Yeah, that's something I know. You know, I've been in areas where, for one reason or another, and sadly, it's some areas that I've seen where there was a lot of oil and gas production. The best thing that happened was the oil and gas production ended. And so there are areas that we've been able to study and go back in and see what nature has been able to do. And it's a process, and it's a slow process, but nature seems to find a way.
She does. There is one exception, the peat bogs. Peat bogs accrete extremely slowly over time. And the digging up of peat in Siberia or Ireland, 50% of Ireland's fuel heat comes from peat.
Yeah.
That can never be replaced.
That's true.
On human timescales or in any timescale that we understand.
And is there some of the same? And explain to me peat bogs and to the listeners. Peat bogs are considered sort of a wetland?
They are a wetland, yeah. Yes. So they are accumulated precipitation. Over time, plants die, but because of the water, they don't decompose rapidly. They decompose very, very slowly because there's not enough oxygen for microbial decomposition to happen rapidly. So plants are growing faster than microbes are breaking them down. They're usually signified by sphagnum moss. So any sphagnum moss that you've ever used in a terrarium or in your gardening came from a peat bog.
Mm. And are there many in the United States, in the continental United States, or in North America?
They're in northern. Around the Great Lakes, you can find bogs. There was a bog up in upstate New York that I visited with my husband earlier this year when we went to see to bury his mother, actually. And it's a little bog off a lake called Rushford Lake where they spent their summers. And I was so thrilled that it had been nationally protected, this little bog. And there were all kinds of families picnicking nearby, but not getting into it. They were just enjoying it. So they understood that it existed and that it was special.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen huge bogs, and I may have seen something in that area. I have seen them in Ireland and in areas in Scotland. Large bog, and I've actually seen farming where they cut these huge bales of out for, as you said, for fuel, to heat their homes and cook with.
Yes, and as climate changes and we see heating up of the atmospheric temperature, rates of decomposition in wetlands move faster because enzymes and microbes are able to work faster.
Correct.
It's a thermodynamic process. In Siberia, the peat is holding a lot of carbon. As it thaws, there is very large concern in the scientific community that carbon that is stored in that peat will be suddenly released into the atmosphere, further increasing our global warming problem.
And we also, I think it was in Ireland, I saw a huge area in a peat bog that was on fire. And
yes.
It had been on fire for years and years and years and years and years. It was just smoking. So I would guess that's also releasing.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We actually saw that in southern Georgia in the Okefenokee, which is officially characterized as a swamp, but it also has several bogs surrounding it that they call prairies, actually filled with pitcher plants. That's one of the indicators of a bog or a fen are carnivorous plants because they need the insects to take in nutrients because the soil does not have enough nutrients for the plants. So they develop this ability to suck in insects through some way, whether they're sticky or have an appendage that allows them to suck in insects to get nutrients. But the Okefenokee started a fire from lightning, and because of the peat, the fire just kept going and going and going for almost a year. That released an enormous amount of carbon into the atmosphere.
And they really just have to sort of put themselves out, correct? I mean, there's no way to put them out.
Hurricanes.
Yeah, hurricanes and a lot of water, I guess, is the only thing that can do that. Now, you're mentioning the pitcher plant. Don't we have some of those in some of the little bog areas in Appalachia?
We do. We do have carnivorous plants here. I've been thrilled to see them as I've hiked and come upon some ephemeral wetlands that we have.
Yeah, I'll tell a quick story about that. I was hiking up near where there's a small bog area, and actually came upon a young lady and her boyfriend picking the plants.
Yeah. Oh, no.
They just thought they were beautiful yellow little flowers and did not have a clue till I come running up there and accost them. But it's a constant educational process. And as soon as I told them and sort of gave the story, the poor young lady was almost devastated, you know, because she just didn't know.
Oh, yeah. And most of the time, I think people are good. They just don't know. And that's why shows like this are important.
What do you think about, I mean, we talked a little bit about Barrier Island restoration and some of the things that are going there. What do you see, and what is science telling us that we do need to do to better protect or to restore our wetlands and areas around? And also, are wetlands covered under the Clean Water Act?
Yes, wetlands are covered under the Clean Water Act. Also, the Wilderness Act is protecting some of these wetlands through national wildlife refuges. To reclaim or protect barrier islands, I would say we need to stop development along coasts. We need to slow it down, back it up. The barrier island that I lived on was a very dynamic environment. And what I mean as a scientist when I say dynamic is that it changes rapidly. And what I mean by changing rapidly was that in the 6.5 years that I lived on Sapelo Island, the channel marker had to be moved twice on the southern end of the island because the island is moving south. It is just a pile of sand. It is being slowly moved south. These are dynamic ecosystems. They need to be allowed to move. We have the sophistication now and knowledge with our satellites and watching things over time and space that we know how to back up, how far to back up to allow these ecosystems to move around.
That's amazing. I don't think most people know that they do move, but they in fact do. And I can remember a scientist that I worked with some in South Louisiana telling me that the barrier islands, they were just like a little floating sandbar.
Oh, they really are. And there was something in my childhood, I don't know if it was church or school, but something about not building your house on the sand, building your house on the rock. And living on that barrier island really brought that home for me. If you build a house on one of these islands, it is a temporary situation.
Structure. Yeah. Yeah, and you know, people don't seem to understand that. I can remember a number of years ago when I was up in the Midwest, around St. Louis when the big, I think in the 90s, when the big floods all happened. And it was amazing to me to watch people on TV complaining about the Corps of Engineers and everything else and blaming FEMA and everyone else because they built their house between the levee and the Mississippi River and couldn't understand why now their $2 million home was flooded. People want the view, they want the real estate, and they don't always think about the consequences of their actions.
Right. And I wonder often if we were better of informing the risk and pushing the risk onto them, if they would still be willing to build those houses.
I think some would, simply because people, until it actually happens to them,
right,
they don't think it will happen to them.
Exactly.
It's kind of like preparing. You're listening to Nature's Edge with Dale Stewart and my guest, Dr. Melissa Booth. We're talking about wetlands, and we shall return.
Yes.
Dale Stewart, we are back with Nature's Edge and my special in-studio guest, Dr. Melissa Booth. And Melissa and I have been talking about pretty much all things wetland and coastal erosion and what has caused our losses in our wetlands and what we can do about them and all of those kind of things. And I did have one other question, Melissa, that was sort of on my mind, and because I know it's being looked at on the Mississippi River. And that is using freshwater and sediment reintroductions by allowing these rivers to sort of go back to their normal flow areas and sort of reintroduce the hydrology of some of these areas. What do you think?
I totally agree. I think remove the levees, Let's let the water take the natural course that it's supposed to, and human beings learn to adapt along the natural waterways that this planet has.
Well, and you know, humans, we really are great adapters, like all animals. We do have the ability to adapt, but the problem is we don't always want to. You know, we still like, you know, a huge percentage of this country's oil and gas comes right through that area of South Louisiana.
Yeah.
And if we're talking about taking out one of the levees on the west side of the Mississippi River to allow that spring flooding to occur, people will just shake their head and they say, oh no, because now you're going to make me move, or that's going to take over my house, or I no longer can farm that area. It is a difficult thing to do. One thing, and I was talking to you earlier about this, that I'm very involved in, as a scientist, I think you can appreciate this, but most of the policies that are being written and most of the ways to deal with our wetlands and our coastal erosion problem has been scientists talking to politicians, and ultimately the politicians writing the laws or writing the policies that deal with this. And they do that oftentimes without actually bringing into the conversation the men and women that live in those areas and that really are most impacted by that. Don't you think we need to get them in the conversation as well?
Absolutely. I don't know if you know a concept, ecosystem services.
I do.
Right. And one of the services that ecosystems provides us is cultural identity. So I know that you're from a Cajun background in the bayous of southern Louisiana. I lived on this island in coastal Georgia. And the people there, the Gullah Geechee people, are descendants of the slaves that worked the plantations of those islands. And they have their own dialect and their own cultural identity. For instance, the artwork of weaving baskets from sea grasses. You can see them in Savannah and Charleston being sold. But these people also have a way of life on these islands. They eat possum. I remember when I interviewed for my job at the University of Georgia Marine Institute, they took me over to George and Lula's over in the community, which is a community of about 70 people still living on Sapelo Island. It's the only private property on that island. And these people welcomed me into their home, and then they put dinner in front of me, and it was raccoon. Mm. And I think that it was a hazing ritual a little bit, and George kind of looked at me. He's like, hey, you gonna eat that? And I was like, yeah, I'm definitely gonna eat it. So I sawed into it, and it was kind of tough and chewy, and he said, what you think it tastes like? I said, it tastes like bear. And he just loved me from then on out, and I loved them. They were such interesting people, and I learned a lot about oystering, shrimping, tidal cycles, how to make products from stones that wash up on the beach, how to identify what they call things that wash up on the beach, and also their religious philosophies, their life philosophies. Those people need a voice.
They do.
And how wetlands are treated.
Oh, absolutely. And that's a very similar type of a culture to the Cajun culture in South Louisiana, where I grew up. I mean, you have two, that is the largest culture in the United States that speaks another language, French, in South Louisiana. And I can remember growing up down there, and my mother's parents spoke French in the home, and the newspaper, the local newspaper was in French. The local radio station was French. So you had this huge bilingual culture down there, and it's still there, but it is changing. The older men and women still live in the marsh, still live in the wetlands. You know, they still fish, they still hunt. So their way of life is drastically being impacted by what's going on down there. I visited one small island down there that some Homa Indians lived on. There was probably only 30 or 40 of them that lived there. No electricity, no running water, but they have lived there their whole life. And I would say the youngest person I met on that little island was probably in their early 60s. They're not going anywhere. And I actually asked them, what are you going to do? Because your little community here is going underwater. They said, we'll just go under with it. You know, we will go down with the ship.
Oh.
They are not willing to give up. But yet, I talked to some younger, and they have some ideas about what needs to be done, but they're just not brought to the table. They're just you know, these dumb people that live in the bayous and the wetlands, but they, these dumb people have some pretty good ideas that they will throw out at you. They may not know exactly how to do it. That's where the scientists and the engineering can help them with that, but they do have suggestions.
Absolutely. And I think that just as we've learned that wetlands are far more productive as natural ecosystems than as agricultural places or filled in landscapes, with maybe the exception of Chicago. I learned that Chicago was built on a wetland, and that's my favorite U.S. city, and I was sort of, oh, okay.
And so is New Orleans.
It's amazing the engineering feats that go into this, but I think that we're learning the ecosystem services that these ecosystems provide to us, the flood control, the groundwater replenishment, the shoreline stabilization, the stormwater protection, the water purification, the biodiversity, wetland products, cultural values, maybe recreation, tourism. All of these things that they provide are worth far more than any rice we could ever grow in these ecosystems. And the people that live and understand them have something to offer us.
Oh, absolutely they do. Let me ask you just real quick, I think I know the answer to this, but do wetlands affect global climate?
Absolutely. So they're a major carbon sink. The sediments that accrete over time, the plants that grow very rapidly and then die every year, accrete and accumulate carbon. So that carbon gets buried. That's considered a carbon sink. One of the concerns is that as the climate warms, we're going to see wetlands like peat bogs release that carbon back to the atmosphere. We're going to see certain areas be inundated by sea level rise, and so no longer accreting plants and accumulating carbon as a sink.
You know, I was in a meeting not long ago about wetlands and wetland conservations, and one of the reporters asked me if I believe the glass was half full of fat or half empty as it, when it came to restoration, and my answer to that is it doesn't matter as long as you're pouring the water.
That's a really good point.
Yeah, so I want to be the person that's pouring the water. So it does have an impact on the global climate. It's not too late, is it, Melissa, for us to do something?
It's not too late, but we're right at the edge. We're definitely pushing the boundary on this crisis. We've probably got 20 to 30 years to make major changes in human behavior on this planet, or the climate is going to go in such a way that we're not going to want to be here in a couple hundred years.
Absolutely, and I agree with you. And I think that cultural change, that cultural mindset that we've got to do, I think is the most difficult task ahead of us, is changing the way people perceive nature in general.
I agree, and I think the toughest thing for people is to admit that we need to change.
Absolutely. Well, folks, wetlands are an important part of our national heritage. Our economic well-being and quality of life largely depend on our nation's wealth of natural resources, and wetlands are the vital link between our land and water resources. As wetlands are lost, the remaining wetlands become even more valuable. We have already lost many of our nation's wetlands since America was first settled. We must now take positive steps to protect wetlands to ensure that the functions and related values that provide that they provide will be preserved for present and future generations. Until next time, get out there and get involved. Find out where wetlands exist near your home. Learn more about them and support educational efforts. Encourage your neighbors, developers, and state and local government to protect the function and value of wetlands in our watershed. Until next time, this is Dale Stewart with Nature's Edge. I will see you in the wild.